Human foolishness is nothing new. In his new short story collection, Robin Hemley explores human foolishness through the ages, from the 1400s through to the future. The collection is called Reply All. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today I'll talk with Robin Hemley about his collection of short stories. He's the director of the nonfiction writing program at the University of Iowa. He's also the editor of Defunct Magazine. We'll talk about the difference between writing fiction and nonfiction. Later in the hour, Michael Feldman, the king of small talk radio, will be here. He's the host of What Do You Know, coming to Cedar Falls this weekend. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. On Saturday, Michael Feldman's What Do You Know will be broadcasting live from the Gallagher Blue Dorn Performing Arts Center in Cedar Falls. Later this hour, I'll talk with Michael, but first we'll start with a different kind of silliness. In his new collection of short stories, Reply All, Robin Hemley explores all kinds of human foolishness. He is the director of the nonfiction writing program at the University of Iowa. He's also the editor of Defunct Magazine. Welcome back to the show, Robin.
Thanks very much.
Thank you so much for being here and fresh off the plane from Australia.
Yeah. I don't know about fresh, but off the plane anyway.
All right. Well, I'm so glad you could take the time to come in and talk with us today. And this collection of stories, this isn't something that you sat down and wrote all at once, right?
No, this collection, it's my third collection. And it has stories in it from as old as 15 years old. So, I mean, most of them have been written within the last 7 years or so. Yeah.
So what ties them together in your mind?
Well, you know, I think that whoever did the blurb copy for the back actually got it right this time. I mean, I think their books, the book is about deception, primarily self-deception, but deception of all kinds. I think that that and sort of our tendency towards hypocrisy is what sort of interests me as a writer. There's a lot of humor can be found there, too.
Is that something that you've spent many years exploring?
Self-deception? Well, doesn't everybody?
I think I was watching the video blurb about the book, and you said that you are a very good liar.
Yeah.
Is that true?
Oh, sure. I mean, I think I was better.
You could be lying to me now.
I could be. Yeah, absolutely. No, I think I was a really good liar as a kid, and that was a great training ground for telling stories. And I also explore that tendency in memoir too, and in nonfiction, the whole idea of approaching any text skeptically, you know, but both skeptically as a reader, but also skeptically as a writer, you know, what do you divulge, what do you choose to divulge, and what do you choose to leave out?
This book surprised me a little bit because I knew what the title was about.
Yeah.
I knew that Reply All was inspired by an experience that a lot of us have had, actually.
Yeah.
of hitting reply all on an email when we intend to send it to just one person. But then getting into the first story, all of a sudden I'm back in the 1400s.
Yeah.
Did you, and you kind of put these stories together almost chronologically, not quite chronologically, but was that intentional?
Well, yeah, I mean, I like to explore things that I have no experience with. I've had a big interest in history, and I travel a lot, and so I pick up these stories, these anecdotes, and that first story that I that's in the collection, The Warehouse of Saints, is based on an anecdote I heard when I was in Europe. And so I don't think I purposely ordered the collection chronologically, but I tried to vary the voices, you know, as much as possible.
What was the anecdote?
So I was in Slovenia, I think, and our tour guide was talking to us about the brisk trade in saints' relics during the Middle Ages, and how, you know, people would sell, you know, all kinds of bones and things like that and pass them off as saint relics, and that certainly there were enough pieces of the true cross to build a bridge over the Seine. You know, I mean, there's way more than could possibly be in a cross.
So you hear something like that, And does it just kind of stick in your mind? Or did you sit down right away and start working on a story?
Well, that was I was really interested in that story from the very beginning, and I really had fun with it. And actually, my family and I were renting a farmhouse outside of Chinon in the Loire Valley later that summer. And there was a tufous stone cave on the property, and I had my laptop. And so every morning I'd go with my cup of coffee into the cave and start writing the story, which took place in the cave. And so that was really fun to sort of write it on location, as it were.
Oh, wow. Can you read us a little bit from that story?
Sure, I'd love to. Okay, it's called The Warehouse of Saints. And it starts with an epigraph by a wonderful poet, Thomas Salomon, "Too many blessings break a man apart." Today we did inventory, my son Dominic and I. 10 shin bones belonging to St. Timothy, 16 tibias of Paul, 4 skulls of John the Baptist, 3 complete skeletons of Mary Magdalene, a jar of teeth simply labeled assorted saints, a cask of desiccated organs, 13 livers of St. Peter, the dried tongues of Judas Iscariot, Simon, and Thomas, fingernail shavings of the great kings of France, including the entire big toenail of Richard the Lionheart, his entrails, too, the scapulas of Saints Catherine and Michael, enough true cross splinters to build a bridge from Chinon to Paris. God even sends us bones on his day of rest, and that confounds me. Are all other mortals deemed worthy enough to share in his rest except us, his bone slaves? Does it concern you, my son, that St. Peter had so many livers, and Mary Magdalene so many skeletons within her? I have asked him this question, and various variations upon it before. But my son is clever, and I marvel at the many reasons we should revere God's contradictions. If God did not prefer the impossible to the possible, and the incomprehensible to the comprehensible, he would not have bothered to give form to the firmament and breath to the earth's confounding creatures. Dominic has reminded me of the loaves and fishes, of the water into wine, of the Holy Trinity, of Christ's body and blood. The Jews believe that 10,000 people heard Moses at Mount Sinai, he says, combing his beard with a comb carved from the ribs of St. Bartholomew. Every Jew alive today has a piece of one of those souls commingled with his own. What the Jews believe is not what I believe, but I use this as an example. The sums of God are not our sums. I am a simple man. Such faith inspires me, though there are times I admit that I doubt the good Dominic and I do. I named my son after St. Dominic, who appeared to me in a dream and cut off his index finger and gave it to me. He said, "Matthias, even the whitened bones of the saints clamor to do God's bidding." Yet it took 16 years before the true nature of Dominic's prophecy was revealed to me. In the early years, I sold herbs and potions concocted by my wife. Only after her death, when our future looked bleakest, did the bones and relics start to mysteriously appear at the mouth of our cave. Then I understood my true calling. In the 2 years since, Dominic and I have built our business into the largest inventory of bones and relics of saints in the Loire Valley.
That's Robin Hemley. He's reading from his collection of short stories called Reply All. That's a selection from a story called Warehouse of the Saints. And from what you told me earlier, you know, all of these relics from these different saints obviously add up to way more than one individual could have, bones and,
right,
and spleens and livers, etc. The idea of having a warehouse with all of these things there at once is very funny. But I think part of the surprise of the story is that your main character so firmly believes in what he's doing.
Mm.
Where did you get inspiration for him?
Well, I've always been interested in people who believe despite evidence to the contrary. I'm always interested in faith and versus delusion, and what our minds are capable of believing. I mean, he, in order to disbelieve, he has to then understand that his son is a fraud, and that his whole life is built on a fraud, and it's sometimes easier to believe in something you know is probably not true than to upset the balance. We do that all the time.
Well, and when I think about people who are going out and selling something that is not true, I think often in this life that those people are believers themselves. And his son needs his father to be a believer.
Right, right. Absolutely. It's true.
That story has some funny elements, but it also brings you to the edge of being very uncomfortable. And that story doesn't make you nearly as uncomfortable as a number of the other stories in your collection. Is that something that you're trying to manipulate your readers to experience?
Well, as a writer of fiction, when I'm writing fiction, I believe actually in nonfiction too, but I always believe in creating tension rather than dissipating it. I mean, tension makes us want to read on, you know, and when I feel uncomfortable or when I feel when I feel something's making me uncomfortable, I realize, well, that's probably good. That's going to, you know, propel the story forward. So my goal as a writer is to get you reading on, and sometimes that's by, you know, creating more and more tension, snowballing it, as it were.
How is it different to write a short story than to write a nonfiction essay?
Well, I think that would probably you'd get a different answer from different writers. But in my case, as a writer of essays and stories and novels and memoirs and such, for me, with a story, I see a kind of dramatic revelation of character through event, through cause and effect. For the essay, which tends to be more sort of the scrim of fiction, is sort of taken off, and I'm, even though it might be a kind of persona, a kind of version of me, I'm speaking to the reader as a version of Robin Hemley. I'm more interested in a kind of excavation of the self, and my essays tend to be more associative, more the way that a poem might be associative. So I'm not following on that sort of cause effect of event so much as seeing how a mind works on the page.
Do you ever start something, a project that is nonfiction, and find yourself thinking, you know what, I can make my point better if I do this in a fictional setting?
I've had the opposite actually happen to me, where I started off writing something as fiction and then turned it into nonfiction. For me, the case in point was my memoir, Nola, about my older sister who was a diagnosed schizophrenic who died at the age of 25 of a prescription drug overdose. And, you know, for years I tried to write her story in a fictional way. And I just couldn't approach who she was or even what I wanted to say that way. And actually, in my first job, I had a lunch with Tobias Wolff, and he said, you know, try this nonfiction. And that's what I did, and it worked.
I'm talking with Robin Hemley. His latest collection of short stories is called Reply All. He'll be reading from that collection tomorrow night at Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City at 7 p.m. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Coming up in a few minutes, Michael Feldman of What Do You Know will be joining us. What Do You Know will be broadcasting live from the Gallagher Blue Door and Performing Arts Center in Cedar Falls coming up on Saturday. You can find out more information about that on our Facebook page and, of course, at iowapublicradio.org. With me right now is Robin Hemley. He is the director of the nonfiction writing program at the University of Iowa. He's also the editor of Defunct Magazine. But today we're talking about fiction. He has just released his latest collection of short stories. It's called Reply All. And Robin, before the break, we were talking a little bit about the utility, really, of fiction versus nonfiction. And you were talking about trying to write about the life of your sister in a fictional way and finding that you needed to write about it in nonfiction instead. Do you usually find that if you make a decision, I'm going to write an essay, I mean, do you usually find that you can decide beforehand where the story is going?
Yeah. When I write an essay, where it's going, I mean, I never know exactly where anything I'm writing is going. And that's part of the pleasure of it, if you will. Sometimes it's frustration, but I definitely see it as a kind of discovery. And sometimes, you know, I'm working on a novel right now, and I wrote 250 pages before I really feel like I understood what the book was finally about and had to go back to the beginning. But that's just part of the process, and I'm fine with that. But I guess I rarely know exactly where I'm going. I have an idea, and then I'm flexible. The artist Milton Avery once said that art is a series of blind corners, and I think that's very true, that you just don't know where you're necessarily going. But there's also that old saw, no surprise for the writer, no surprise for the reader. So it's good sometimes not to know.
Do you find that you need to switch back and forth between fiction and nonfiction to find a balance within yourself?
Yeah. I mean, I'm not sort of genre specific. I don't declare genre loyalty, I'm afraid. I grew up in a family of writers. My father was a poet, novelist, translator, and editor, and my mother was a short story writer and a novelist. And, you know, when I was, I always wrote from an early age, but they didn't sit me down and say, now, Robin, you're going to have to decide when you're 18 which of us you love more, you know? And so I've always been a bit baffled by the sort of rigid genre lines that we create in this country. It's not universal. You know, in France, in the bookstores there, they have a literature section, and short stories and memoir and all of that's all in the literature section. And it seems to me that we try to parse these things a little too finely here. And so I've always written short stories, poems, essays, and so on, and I get different pleasures from each one.
As the director of the nonfiction writing program at the University of Iowa, do you talk to your students about not defining themselves too rigidly?
I don't have a sort of intake lecture with them where I say, now, I don't want you to, you know, declare. I mean, they tend to be very motivated and even self-guided in some ways. And so I think, you know, if the subject comes up, we talk about it. But they often have, you know, every writer has his or own view on that subject and what they feel comfortable writing about. Some of them, I mean, I went to the writer's workshop. I graduated from the writer's workshop a long time ago, and I was writing poetry and fiction at the same time. And I was, I think I applied to about 7 schools, and half of them I was rejected in fiction and accepted in poetry, and the other half I was accepted in poetry and rejected in fiction. So Iowa, I got into fiction, but I took a lot of poetry classes as well. And some of the best, the most useful classes I took at the workshop were from the poets, like specifically a course on memory and the imagination from the late poet Larry Levis. Completely changed, really helped me in terms of all the genres.
Memoir is so incredibly popular right now. And, of course, readers seem to be loving memoir at the moment, which means that we have a whole lot of people writing memoir. And you work with, not all of your students are young, but I mean, many of them are quite young. How do you feel about people who are 28 years old or 30 years old writing memoir? Is that, 'cause sometimes as a reader, I think, wait a minute, isn't it a bit early in your life to be writing memoir?
Well, you know, not all of the students, of course, are writing memoir. Some are writing memoir, some are writing lyric essay, some are writing literary journalism, and some are writing things that I couldn't define necessarily. But the memoirists, I think it's the quality of the mind and what you have to say rather than your age. I mean, you could live a very long life and still approach your life superficially, and you could live a very brief life and have amazing insights. I mean, for instance, we only have to look at a poet like the French poet Rimbaud, who stopped writing at the age of 19. You know, and I do think that there are some remarkable young writers who write memoir, personal essay at a young age. I mean, I think it's true that as you get older, the sort of idea of self-reflection becomes, hopefully as a writer, becomes even more ingrained. But certainly that's been in my life. But and I don't think I could have written a very good memoir at the age of 22, but I think some of my writers in the program can.
I'm talking with Robin Hemley. He is the director of the nonfiction writing program at the University of Iowa. He's just released a new collection of short stories called Reply All. And could you read part of another story for us? I mentioned, I guess the first one took place in the 1400s, and this one takes us way back in time as well.
Yeah, this is, I think, a little more modern, 1500s. This takes place on the ship that Magellan sailed to the Philippines, where he was killed, and by a local chieftain named Lapu-Lapu. And I decided to set the story to make my main character a Portuguese spy in his employ, who is the translator for Magellan, who gets Magellan killed on purpose by purposefully mistranslating everything that the native emissary has to say. So this is sort of in the middle of that. Lapu-Lapu sent an emissary to Raja Humabon's village, where we were billeted, to invite us to his village and host a feast in our honor. He said he would give us animals and foodstuffs. Magellan reacted favorably and asked me to convey that we would be happy to visit and that we would bring something that would change their lives forever for the better. I told the emissary, a young man all in tattoos, to tell the chief that we would come, but only if he gave us twice as much as was offered. Otherwise, we would bring disease and calamity and change their lives forever. One could tell by the emissary's glance that no one had ever spoken to Lapu-Lapu in this fashion. His stupefied expression Magellan mistook for one of gratitude. The next day he returned and said Lapu-Lapu would like us to leave. If we agreed, he would give us three times the number of foodstuffs, etc., that he had first offered. "I'm afraid he rejects your gift," I told the captain. "He says it's blasphemy of the blackest kind." The captain was a patient man, and he told me to tell the chief that the seas of his land were rich with fish, and while his people enjoyed the bounty of the seas on earth, they would starve in the afterlife if they did not bathe in the water of life and surrender to the fisher of souls. It was a dreary speech. I'd had to translate it or its variants countless times, but it was well spoken. The captain's own words impressed him deeply. He placed his hand to his chest and dreamily glanced at a cloud that had the shape of a dragon. I told the emissary that there was a certain delicious fish in these waters that we had named in honor of his chief. I said we were a hungry people and with great appetites, and that we would eat Lapu-Lapu and his people, and then we would eat the fish named after him, and then we would drink the sea in which they swam, and still our appetites would not be quenched. The emissary backed away quickly and fled over the sands. The next day we did not see him, but the day after that he returned with another offer, this time double his last, if we would leave and not return.
Where did the inspiration for this character come from?
Well, I was reading about Magellan, and I was reading about his death, and I have been interested in the ways that we misunderstand each other, and I figure this guy going around the Philippines, I've spent a lot of time in the Philippines, and I've thought this guy going around the Philippines converting people and sort of doing martial demonstrations and trying to, he must have seemed like such a strange figure to a lot of people there. And I just thought this was a wonderful opportunity for to explore in terms of fiction. So I'm not exactly sure the moment of inspiration, but I was in the Philippines at the time, and I just had been doing some research on Magellan. I thought I'd love to set a little piece of historical fiction there.
When I read that story, I was thinking back to all of the conquistadors and the moment that they landed and encountered the natives, and how many misunderstandings must really have arisen, because, of course, a translation would have been almost impossible. I mean, they were communicating without a common language. Did you think about that and the other conquistadors and how they encountered native people when you were trying to create this moment?
Yeah, definitely. And oddly enough, I think sometimes certain stories are sort of in the zeitgeist, as it were, because I know of two other stories were very different from each other. It's not plagiarism in any way, but two other writers who wrote who completely on their own had a similar theme. One was my friend, a Filipino writer named Luis Francia, who wrote a play about the translator. And this completely, and we were both shocked when we found out we'd written the same subject. And then a story in the Iowa Review by someone else who also took this as a theme, and it just happened at the same time. It's weird how that happens sometimes. I mean, this is not a singular event. I know of many cases where books, novels have been written about really odd things, like the original, quote, Siamese twins, Cheng and Eng. Two novels about them came out within 6 months of each other, you know. And so I think sometimes you sort of tap into something and other people are tapping into it as well.
Let's talk about the title story. And I'm not going to ask you to read it for us. There are some adult themes in the story, so I think we're probably better off leaving some of that to the imagination. But it gives us the title for the book, Reply All. And where did that idea come from?
Well, this idea came slightly from personal experience. I was living at the time in Salt Lake City. I was teaching at the University of Utah. And a friend of mine and I were both on the board of a group called Writers at Work, just a volunteer group. And my friend sent out an email about the next meeting of the group. And I had recently been over to dinner at her house, but had been appallingly late. And I felt really guilty and wanted to apologize. So I sent her an apology, some abject apology. And unfortunately, I sent it to the entire group. And I got a few funny replies from people. And I was embarrassed, but not as embarrassed as I could have been.
Sure.
And so I thought, well, what would be the worst case scenario? And I think that's often what I try to do in fiction, is always think about the worst case scenario and then go there. So I just thought of, I just piled on. I thought of, first of all, the most embarrassing email you could write. And then I just piled on one bad thing after another. And, you know, it was really fun to write. Very tense. I probably – it's a story I like to read. It's one of my stories that that tends to read well out loud, and I might read it tomorrow night at Prairie Lights.
Well, it's a very, very funny story. And in that story, like you said, you just keep piling it on and making this horrible situation worse and worse and worse with each reply. Do you ever find, wait a minute, I've gone too far. That's not believable, and you have to rein things in.
Well, yeah. I mean, if something is not believable, then you have to take it out.
But how do you know?
Other people tell you. They'll just say, no, take that out. That's, you know, the value of criticism. After I'm done with a story, I tend to show it to someone I trust. And they'll sometimes say, no, that's a little too much. Because I do have a kind of silly sense of humor. And on occasion, it can go overboard. So I value people will let me know.
it was very, very funny. And
thank you.
I don't think you went too far. But boy, I was surprised at how far you went, which I guess is the ideal, right?
Right.
So what's next for you?
Well, as I said, I'm working on this novel at the moment and sort of rewriting it in the second draft. It's a novel that takes place in the Philippines. It's one of those things that when you're in a long project, they tend to consume you and confuse you, and you tend to obsess about them. So that's really what I'm engaged in at the moment. And I'm also working on a conference that's taking place in Melbourne, Australia, called Nonfiction Now, which we've run here at the University of Iowa 3 times, and now we're bringing it to our sister UNESCO World City of Literature, Melbourne, in November.
This has been a year of a lot of releases for you. Reply All just came out, and also this year, A Field Guide for Immersion Writing. And I realize that in the literature world, in the book world, whatever just comes out doesn't necessarily reflect what you've been working on most recently.
Right,
obviously, there is some lag time. But how do you, when you're working on something like a novel, how do you juggle all of these other projects at the same time? How do you maintain your focus?
It's hard. It's definitely hard. I think laptops are a great invention, and so I write on planes. I write wherever I
or caves.
Caves or wherever. You know, I think that you find the time, and that you have to do that. And if you are in that sort of obsessive stage of a book, then your mind's not going to turn off in regard to that. And so every little spare moment you have, you're going to go and work on it. You still focus on other things that you have to focus on. But I find that that's the only way to get a book done.
Robin, thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Robin Hemley is the director of the nonfiction writing program at the University of Iowa. He's also the editor of Defunct Magazine. He just released a collection of short stories. It's called Reply All, and he'll be reading from that collection tomorrow night at 7 o'clock at Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City. Coming up in just a moment, Michael Feldman, the host of What Do You Know from Public Radio International. The show is coming to Iowa this weekend. It will be at the Blue Dorn, or the Gallagher Blue Dorn Performing Arts Center in Cedar Falls on Saturday. I'll talk to Michael Feldman in just a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. And coming up on Saturday, Michael Feldman's What Do You Know will be broadcasting live from the Gallagher Blue Dorn Performing Arts Center in Cedar Falls. And with me right now is Michael Feldman, the host of the show. Hello, Michael.
Hi, how are you, Charity?
Good. Thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thanks for having me.
We've got a little time here to chat, so I thought maybe we could go back in time and explore your career a little bit. When did you get started in radio?
I think it was in late 1800s. We did it. It was sort of a stagecoach stop sort of thing. No, we started, it was in the mid-90s, I'd say, somewhere.
Well,
but we really got underway.
Sure,
it started before that, but it takes about a decade to get really up to speed. So.
Well, you had been a teacher for a while before getting into broadcasting?
Right. Teacher, cab driver, radio personality.
And there
whole
was
resume. It's not much, but it's all I have.
But you sort of went back and forth. I mean, you were in broadcasting for a little while, then you drove a cab, then you were back in broadcasting. What was it?
Then I was back in a cab.
What was it that kept pulling you back to radio?
What kept pulling me back to the cab company really is the question. I had numerous failures. You know, you always think, you know, well, people say, you know, so successful. I've had like 10 failures for every success. And that's true of everybody in radio, I think, is that, you know, especially in commercial radio, I mean, they change format on you and suddenly you're Spanish language, and if you don't fit in, you're out, you know. But in my case, it's been, you know, different attempts at careers that didn't go anywhere. And I always came back to Wisconsin, though, so it's been good for me.
Well, and you did, you worked for WGN for a while.
That was one of them. That was one I was trying to avoid mentioning.
But when you
also
were
known as Who Goes Next, you know, that was
right, cool. Right. When you were trying to break into broadcasting, what did you want to be?
I didn't think about it that much. I've never been goal oriented. I got into radio accidentally because I volunteered at a local public station, community station here in Madison. It was Christmas. I was teaching and it was Christmas vacation and I was depressed. I usually get Christmas depression. Goes back years. And so I volunteered at the station, and they had me deliver their newspapers. And eventually I got on air and started doing stuff. And it was just something I knew I could do, but I never really thought about it. I never went to Comm Arts or anything or had any prep for it. So, you know, I didn't really have any goals as far as after a while, I thought it would be nice to stay on the air more than 18 months at any particular gig, you know. So that was a goal, I guess.
When you left Chicago, when you left WGN, we'll call it that.
Under duress.
Right. You started What Do You Know shortly after that.
Yeah.
How did that happen?
I bounced back with What Do You Know. Well, it was, and I wanted to stay in Chicago, actually, and get my name back. Not that I ever had one. But so, I went down to, you know, the office there. You got a report for unemployment on Dearborn, I think it was. And they asked, you know, what I said, well, I want to do, you know, radio work. You know, morning show would be good. And they said, they offered me lawn care. So I knew I had to find something else, you know, because lawn care wasn't going to do it at that point. And the guy from Madison, Jack Mitchell, Wisconsin Public Radio, said, why don't you come back and do a show? And I said, I don't know. He said, you know, come on, let's talk about it. So we met halfway in Rockford, and I came up with the most preposterous proposal I could think of, which was, what do you know, was doing a live, national live radio show, call-in, maybe a quiz call-in, so we don't have to talk about important things, and release it nationally. And he said, well, okay, let's give it a try. And we did. That was a good Jack Mitchell imitation, by the way, but no one knows it. I was stuck, you know.
Right. But, you know, after trying, as you said, and failing, what a crazy thing to succeed with. I mean, I've worked in radio for a long time, and walking up to somebody and pitching a national show doesn't normally work that well.
It doesn't work. It didn't work that well, really, in the beginning. We went on nationally to about 8 stations, I think it was. So that's where we started throwing a dart at the map to make it sound like we were in all these places we hit on the map, you know, with our dart, and we talked about them. But we were on it, none of them, you know.
Did you have an inspiration when you put the show together? Was there something that you were aspiring to?
Basically, I just wanted to utilize the 3 skills that I have in life. You know, I can free associate. I can talk in front of people. It's actually motivating. I don't talk if there's no people around, you know, or 1 or 2. I don't talk. But if I have a crowd, I don't mind talking in front of a crowd. And there was one other skill I have. Oh, I can use a telephone. And that's it. So so it's perfect for me. When I was in high school, I won a couple of contests to be on the air, you know, on radio shows and stuff. And, you know, in the back of my mind, I always thought I could do it, you know. But that's about the extent of it.
Being on the air for 2 hours live every week, you talk about free association. You do so much thinking on your feet and responding to the audience.
But I can't think when I sit down. That's my problem.
Do you think that it takes a special disposition to be able to? That's a pretty high tension situation for a lot of people. You're really performing without a net. Do you think it takes a special disposition to be able to do that?
That's a very kind way of putting it. Actually, a special disposition. Yeah, that's what I got. I think it's sort of a dysfunction. Sometimes you can have a dysfunction that you can make pay, and for me, it's all these kind of useless. You know, without radio, I'd be totally unemployable. Well, teaching. I taught for a while. You can do sort of the same stuff, but then you got to grade papers and things, and there's, you know, it's annoying. So, but you know, radio is the only place it would work, I think.
Do you think you're different on stage than you are in person?
Not too much, I'm told. My daughters are always saying. I mean, we said yesterday we had a bunch of friends over. My youngest, who's now a college girl, with her friends, and they were over, and you know, they're talking about the fact that her friends are real excited that her dad was Michael Feldman. Nora was saying, I hear it every day, you know. I hear it every day.
Do you try out material on your family?
No, that's just the way I talk, you know. In fact, my wife is absolutely the worst audience because she is the most literal person I've ever met. So if I say something to her that I think is funny, or that is funny, as far as I'm concerned, she will examine it for its literal meaning. And then, you know, it's just too frustrating to deal with. And my daughters are just, you know, they love their dad, but they hear it every day.
I'm talking with Michael Feldman. He's the host of What Do You Know from Public Radio International, and the show will be live in Cedar Falls this coming weekend. You can find out more about that on our website, iowapublicradio.org. We've also put up a link on our Facebook page, Iowa Public Radio, so you can find out more. And if you'd like to talk to Michael Feldman, you're welcome to join our conversation. The number to call is 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. From when you first started the show in 1985 to when you say you really got going in the 90s, how did it change?
Not at all, really. You just find your audience after a while, or you don't, you know. So, the audience is sort of self-selected out, you know. Certainly when you first go on the air, anybody, I think, when you go on the air, you have about equal numbers of people loving you and hating you. And it's kind of bad because if you're a sensitive person at all, you know, you get a lot of, you don't go on there really to be mean to people or to, you go on and try to entertain, you know. But a lot of people hate you or don't like you for a certain thing that they pick up in you, you know. And after a while, the hope is that the ones who like you finally exceed the ones who don't, you know. So, and that's it. And then you have a career.
Has that been hard for you at times, having people who send you nasty letters and don't like you?
I don't get, you know, the problem is with any of this, as you know, is that people only send a letter when they're upset about something, you know. So, and then all the people, you know, who love it, they just sit there and they giggle or whatever, and, you know. So you sort of have to get used to that notion.
Now, people are much more motivated to do something about it when they're upset.
Especially with email now and all that stuff, you know. It's a little too easy.
Michael is on the line from Harper, another Michael. He'd like to join the conversation. Hi, Michael.
Hello. Michael Feldman, this is Michael Berg, and I've been on your show as
hey,
a contestant. And I've been you've interviewed me several times. I was a poet, okay?
Yeah.
Anyway, I was totally amazed about you, how you you can go back to a conversation from three or four times back, pre-associate. And
yes.
That is the most effective means of comedy I think I've ever I've seen. And I think you're very good. You're the, one of the best I've ever seen at it, at a pre-associate.
Thanks. I didn't even know I did that, so I'm...
You do too know it. You know.
Well,
it,
I do is pre-associate. When I was teaching school, you know, teaching English, I called English as a second language for Americans, you know. But I was teaching it, and my kids delighted in getting me off the track because I go off on tangent. I'm always off on a tangent, but I can go off on a tangent from a tangent, and that's what they did. So it's just, you know, it's a dysfunction.
Michael, thanks a lot for your call. And Michael Feldman, one of the things that I really enjoy about the show are your interviews. I mean, it's somewhat like a late-night talk show in many ways because you have the comedy, you have the music, you have other elements, but you are an excellent interviewer.
Thank you.
What have you done to develop that technique?
You know, I really had to learn to listen. I didn't start out to be a radio person or a performer or anything like that, but I'm just the sort of person who says stuff, and then I wouldn't listen to any, there wasn't supposed to be a response, you know. that was the only reason for saying stuff. Most of it was to not get a response. And then I started doing shows and interviewing people stuff. Well, you know, if you listen to what they say, first of all, if you're interested in what they're there for, you know, their book or whatever, and actually read it and all that, and then it's about them, you know. And I had to actually learn to do that, and I really like doing it now because it's about them. It's all about the guest, you know. And you're there not to score points on them, but you're there to bring out stuff. And if you can do it in a light way and with humor, it just makes it easier for everybody, you know.
You do some interviews that I consider to be very challenging interviews. I have found that in my interviewing career, it's sometimes very difficult to interview funny people because
I step back and let them go. You know?
Right, but sometimes it's hard to get them going. When you want to play the straight man because, as you said, it's about them. It's not about you, but you also have to somehow get them started.
Now,
how do you do that?
What I found the most challenging are usually writers, authors, or people who are used to being interviewed or talking about their work and stuff, because they go off on their message. You know, they hit all their points, and it's hard to get them off. You know, I mean, I've talked to I won't even say who, but I mean, people I love, the great writers and so forth. But you can just take a line or a phrase from their book, and they'll do the whole page for you. You know. In explaining it, and it's hard to get them off that and get them onto and sort of subvert them into actually saying something they haven't been saying all the time, you know. So that's the challenge with that, I think.
How do you prepare for interviews?
Well, I do read the books. unlike Larry King, who said he'd never read a book. You see, he approaches it like, you know, well, why should I read your book? You know, but you know, I read them all, and then I write all over the books in ink usually, so they can't be passed on to anybody. And then, you hit one or two points to get things going, and then you start trying to get them going, you know, to elaborate and give examples and or whatever. If you're interested in the book, it shows, I think.
After doing this for so many years, is it still fun?
Yes, it really is. Surprisingly, I guess. I don't know. It's dangerously close to being my life. That's sort of a problem that I should really speak with someone about. But yeah, it's really fun. I enjoy it because each show is different, and it's always different people there and different things we're talking about. And the only thing that's same is me, I guess, but can't change that.
What do you do to keep it fresh?
It's basically that. It always is fresh. It's always something different. It's always something with you, like my mother used to say.
What's your favorite part of the show?
Mostly I'd say it's the audience interactions, usually with people who are there, who come to the show. And, you know, because a person who comes to a radio show is a special person to begin with. You know, you got to admire that. And, I enjoy those interactions. People always say funny things, and that's pretty cool.
Do you have any kind of a radar for knowing who's going to be good when you're going through the audience and engaging with people?
Yes, but it's a very faulty radar, more of a sonar. I always think I read auras or something, but I really don't. But I, you know, try to look for like a blue-green aura. It would be the best if I could see it.
So it's really luck of the draw in many ways.
Pretty much. You look for rapid eye movement, that sort of thing.
After doing this for so long, after traveling around with the show a great deal, is there something left that you really want to make sure happens before you decide to retire?
I don't know. Maybe like a reality TV show.
Sure. Based good luck with that.
Yeah, some of the same principles and so forth. You know. No, I never was ambitious, and I'm still not. I'll say that for me.
With the show at this point, and with some other people, some very well-known people in public radio, the Car Talk guys are retiring. Garrison Keillor is talking again about retiring. Does that make you think about when it's time to say goodbye?
No, opportunity knocks.
You could have three shows.
Air slots. We're talking air slots here. You know, Garrison vacates a huge air slot. I mean, a huge one. It's like a hangar. It's so big. And so, you know, and the Car Talk guys, too, you know, click and clack. Someone's got to, I'll be happy to talk cars. Anybody wants to ask me about a car?
So you're looking for a five-hour show now instead.
I don't know every model of vehicle. But I've had some pretty good with your GM vehicles and with your Hondas. I'm strong. And other people can call in and help with the other stuff. So I think we're good.
All right. Michael, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you very much.
Michael Feldman is the host of What Do You Know from Public Radio International. The show will be broadcasting live from the Gallagher Blue Dorn Performing Arts Center in Cedar Falls on Saturday. You can find out more on our website, iowapublicradio.org. You can also check it out on our Facebook page, Iowa Public Radio. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese and Emily Woodbury. Our executive producer is Jeff Schmidt. Production assistance today from Allison Sullivan. Our theme music was composed and performed by the River Monks. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow on the show, I'll talk with author Dave Bartimus about his book, We Call Her Keely.